Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Policing Ferguson, Policing America. What really happened? And what the country can learn from it. By Thomas Jackson. Narrated by Todd McLaren. Preface. The name of Ferguson, Missouri means a lot of different things to different people. To me, it means home. It's where I staked my life and my livelihood. My father moved our family from my boyhood home in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in 1966 to take a job as an electrical engineer at Emerson Electric Company in Ferguson. He and my mother also owned a paint and craft shop, one block from the police station, where I worked when I was in high school. So much of what people believe about what happened in Ferguson, and about the town and its people, is completely untrue. Thanks to the news media, the internet, and a deeply flawed government examination. Still, some of the larger issues that Ferguson has come to represent are real and of critical importance to the future of the country. I do hope to set the record straight, not just about the shooting and the police response to it, but about what America can and should expect from its law enforcement professionals. What was considered a noble, maybe even heroic, calling only a few years ago, became the perceived source of all of America's woes practically overnight. In writing this book, I hope to do my part in restoring the public trust to police, but I don't want the discussion about policing to continue to serve as a distraction from more basic social concerns, failing programs that get in the way of the very benefits they were intended to provide. Have created a cycle of poverty and stagnation that law enforcement deals with every day. I hope to share my experience in a way that opens that conversation and starts us on a path toward police, all citizens, in fact, playing a more proactive role in improving the lives of all Americans. Introduction. In August 2014, on a hot Saturday afternoon in Missouri, Officer Darren Wilson of the Ferguson Police Department shot and killed Michael Brown. America was transfixed for months by the protests, the riots, the never-ending news cycle. What was considered a noble, even heroic calling, police work, came to be perceived as the source of America's woes practically overnight. The name of Ferguson became shorthand for institutional racism and police brutality. I was the chief of police for Ferguson. The incident that resulted in the death of Michael Brown and the terrible aftermath that all but destroyed the town happened on my watch. I spent months on the hot seat, the primary focus of a nation's outrage. It was probably more important to me than to anyone else to understand where that anger came from, to realistically assess how much of it was justified and how much resulted from people jumping to conclusions based on a dangerous cocktail of provocative media reports and inflammatory pronouncements by politicians and activists, amplifying misperceptions that had spread on the internet faster than any investigation could possibly proceed. Since resigning my post in the wake of the U.S. Department of Justice's scathing report, I've had the time and motivation to examine all the things said about Ferguson. Even if there weren't lawsuits that required me to be clear about the facts, I needed to know for my own peace of mind where people came up with the claims they made about my force and our town. As a professional, I wanted to know what we were doing wrong and how to fix what could be fixed, even if my days as chief in Ferguson were over. This book is a product of that examination. I cannot begin without first addressing two things: the Department of Justice report on Ferguson, and the fact that there was so much coverage of events in Ferguson that people say, "I know what I saw. You can't deny it." You know what you saw. There's a difference between "I know what I saw" and "I know what I was shown." Even if you came to Ferguson to see with your own eyes, there were places you couldn't have gone, meetings you couldn't have attended. All I ask is that you give me a chance to show you what wasn't shown. to take you where you couldn't have gone. The DOJ report, though, needs to be discussed right here, right off the bat. Attorney General Eric Holder of the Department of Justice first arrived in Ferguson 11 days after the shooting. He spoke with Michael Brown's mother. He talked of his own experiences with prejudice. He stated publicly that his pledge included, as opposed to simple justice, robust action. And he stated that long after the events of August 9th have receded from the headlines, the Justice Department will continue to stand with this community. The things he said and did added up to a tacit confirmation of the public fear that wrong had been done, the shooting had been bad, and that prejudice was a factor. And it was all broadcast live. It not only cemented the Department of Justice's biased stance in the upcoming investigation, but also turned up the heat of public anger. He made the job of law enforcement even harder than it already was, putting the public and police both at greater risk. Attorney General Holder did all of this more than 3 months before the investigation into the shooting concluded. 3 months before the facts were in. His mind was made up before he arrived in town. Following his August 20 pledge and his September resignation, Holder appeared at the Washington Ideas Forum on October 29th, where he declared, "I think it's pretty clear that the need for wholesale change in that department, Ferguson, is appropriate." The Los Angeles Times later quoted sources in the Justice Department saying, "The more he gets out in front publicly, the more he will be expected to deliver criminal charges. The situation could reach a tipping point where federal criminal charges would be the only way to vindicate Holder's public comments." Then, the investigations into the shooting concluded, and the forensics showed that the narrative that had gained such traction with the public didn't fit the evidence. The officer's version of events did. To those who write here would immediately jump to thinking, "Staged scene, cover-up," I have included an appendix, so you can hear the findings yourself. Mind you, what I've included is not from an internal police investigation. It's from a federal investigation, because the FBI, a division of the DOJ, was sent to look into this at the same time that Holder was sent. The FBI came, stayed off camera, and did their jobs. They actually investigated before reaching their conclusions. They brought in the evidence, and it supported the police officer whom Holder had tacitly condemned. It's one thing for a shopkeeper to say, "I might have made an unfair rush to judgment here," and quite another for the Attorney General of the United States to say, "Oops." What are the odds of a fair and unbiased investigation if the person directing it is thoroughly invested in finding something that will vindicate him rather than in finding the truth? The DOJ investigation started with the premise that Ferguson was a swamp of injustice, then sought out and published anything that looked like it supported that position. I don't want to imply that the department I led was immaculate, that no Ferguson officer ever engaged in questionable behavior, and I don't deny that there are systemic problems or that the criminal justice system is in need of lasting reform. But the Ferguson portrayed in that report was an invention, a backwards, angry place that the Justice Department created to make a show of tearing it down. 7 months after the shooting, and 3 months after the grand jury had ruled that there were no grounds to indict the officer involved, I was summoned to meet with representatives of the DOJ prior to the report's release. As the city's manager, attorney, mayor, and I went into the meeting, we were required to surrender cell phones and recording devices, as if they didn't want anybody to know what they were about to say. We listened in horror as the DOJ lead investigator outlined the essential findings in the report. A stunned Stephanie Carr, our city attorney, protested, "You can't say those things. That's not true. It won't hold up in litigation." The DOJ investigator replied coldly, "Well, we aren't litigating, are we?" In the court of public opinion, there is no standard of proof, much less a defense team. We knew their report was a distorted misrepresentation, but they counted on the public not to question it. By the time sources like the Wall Street Journal condemned them for the meaningless way they used statistics, for example, it was too late. The damage was done. I still shake my head over how easily they could publish a report filled with so much that met with no evidentiary standards simply by playing to what everybody knew. Everybody knew. How quickly a few social media reports grew into everybody knows. It was like a chain reaction that got out of control. Social media sources and traditional media sources were feeding off each other. The crowds were responding to what the police were doing. The more it escalated, the more people showed up. And the more people showed up, the more it escalated. It was a toxic feedback loop. My grim observation in Ferguson was that media representatives and politicians, whose careers depend on keeping in favor with the public, let themselves be swept up by the viral version. They lost objectivity. They did not wait for the facts. True justice stands upon the facts, no matter how much they fly in the face of popular perception. True justice is impartial, and for everyone. Justice for some is an eye for an eye, a life for a life. It means doing unto others as they have done unto you. But that's not justice. That's vengeance. Vengeance wants to inflict pain on another because pain was inflicted on you. That doesn't remove the pain. It doubles the pain, and is especially harmful if the pain is inflicted on those who never deserved it, as in Ferguson. A desire for vengeance comes from anger, frustration, and passion. It has destruction as a goal. Destruction of what was wrong, but it extends to anything else the anger turns upon as well. A desire for true justice comes from reason, and it holds out hope. The foundation of justice must rest upon the truth in all its complexity to build something new. Chapter 1. Officer Involved Fatal Shooting. In August 2014, I was serving as chief of police in Ferguson, Missouri. Population about 21,000. It sounds like a small town, and to many across the country, just saying Missouri conjures rural imagery. In fact, Ferguson is one of about 90 municipalities in St. Louis County. The nearby city of St. Louis is its own county with its own government. The Metrolink rail and Metro bus systems connect and serve both the city and county within the greater metropolitan area. About two-thirds of the municipalities, like Ferguson, have their own police departments. Some combine resources and some contract with St. Louis County. Some areas are unincorporated and rely solely on St. Louis County for services. Some, like Ferguson, are served by their own fire departments. Others are served by fire districts, and a few have a mixture of the two, thanks to annexations over the years. School districts, like fire districts, are their own taxing bodies, independent of local governments, and often cross municipal lines. Ferguson is served by two different school districts. From Ferguson, drive 20 minutes one direction, and you're in downtown St. Louis City at the Arch. Go 10 minutes the other direction, and you're at the airport. In the middle of urban sprawl, Ferguson contains everything from apartments and starter homes to mansions, local shops to major chain stores, and small businesses to one of the Fortune 500. The city boasts 11 parks, an aquatic center and a community center, 19 churches, great places to eat, an organic apprenticeship farm, and thriving farmers market, and one of three area-wide community colleges. A sign welcomes you to historic Ferguson. Its motto, Proud Past, Promising Future. It has been designated a Playful City USA community and an Arbor Day Foundation Tree City USA. I had been chief in Ferguson since 2010 and a cop for 35 years. My first 31 years were with the St. Louis County Police Department, where I retired as a captain. I came to police work after a stint as a paramedic, because being an EMT made me feel like I was always getting involved in situations after the damage was done. I didn't want to just pick up the victims. I wanted to be in a position to prevent people from becoming victims in the first place. August 9th, 2014, was my day off, and I was a distance from town when I received a chilling call. There had been an officer-involved fatal shooting on Canfield Drive, near the intersection of West Florissant Avenue. That put the shooting in the middle of an area containing many federally subsidized housing units. In the years before I became police chief, the number of public housing units there had grown very quickly along Canfield and North Winds Estates Drives. The residents made up a significant percentage of the town's population. Most of the residents were low-income, many working multiple low-wage jobs to try to provide for their families, and many were on some form of public assistance. I had seen right away, from assessing our crime statistics, that they were dealing with the highest concentration of both petty crimes and more serious, sometimes violent crimes, in their neighborhoods. When I first came on the job in Ferguson, many of the public apartment complexes were physically falling apart, largely ignored by inattentive management companies working for absentee landlords who just sat back and collected federal subsidies. Over time, we tracked down the owners of all the buildings, some living as far away as Massachusetts, and one by one, got them to enter into agreements with the city to clean up their properties. This went beyond long-neglected maintenance and repairs, and called on the owners to improve the quality of life in other ways. We asked the owners to issue vehicle parking stickers, provide security guards and cameras throughout the apartment complexes, and enforce occupancy and safety codes. The process of installing the security cameras was underway in the area, and that August, it was about 2 weeks from completion. This didn't address the real underlying problem of concentrated poverty, but at the very least, it was one step toward making these neighborhoods more livable. I'm sure there were any number of local, state, and federal agencies better equipped, better trained, and with sufficient resources to improve the state of housing for their residents. But in their absence, we, local law enforcement, were the ones there, feet on the ground. So we sponsored job fairs and volunteer programs and established community resource officers, CROs, to help businesses and neighborhoods identify and resolve problems. We partnered with the school district to provide school resource officers, SROs, to establish rapport with students, teach the DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education Program, and give teachers a point of contact with the police department. We helped the residents establish neighborhood watch associations. I served on commissions trying to attract new businesses to bring new jobs to the area, and worked with a municipal court to arrange public service sentencing alternatives, expunging fines, and creating amnesty programs. I urged my officers to be a presence in the neighborhood, getting to know people, off-duty as well as on the job. I can't even count the number of ball games, church picnics, block parties, and fairs that either I or one of my officers attended. We had been in the Canfield Green Apartments not long before, out of uniform, handing out flyers urging residents to attend the grand opening of our new community center. The city had undertaken these efforts on its own initiative to improve trust and quality of life. But there's a high changeover rate in public housing, and new people would come in unfamiliar with us and our efforts. We were working constantly to improve trust, but the police can gain only so much traction in the face of poverty, governmental mismanagement, and cultural predisposition. Still, we came to the community the same way we had come to the job, to do what could be done. When the call came in on that hot August day, and the veteran sergeant on the phone said, "It's getting ugly here," of an incident that was only minutes old, I felt like a societal EMT, dealing with the consequences because I could not address the true causes. I turned my car back toward Ferguson to put on my uniform and do my job. But in this case, part of my job was handing the investigation over to someone else. My first call was to Dan DeCarli, chief of detectives on the Ferguson force. Dan was a seasoned investigator and the commander of the major case squad of Greater St. Louis, which is composed of detectives from various departments and responds to unsolved homicides area-wide as needed or requested. DeCarli already had his team from Ferguson on the way out to start working the scene. I told Dan that I felt it would be prudent to turn the investigation of the shooting over to another law enforcement agency, in this case, the St. Louis County Police Department. He agreed that our professional and capable detectives would not conduct the investigation to avoid any appearance of impropriety. I phoned Chief John Belmar of the county police and laid out the situation. Belmar assured me he would immediately take over the investigation and also have his people take over the scene of the shooting. John and I had worked together for years, and I had complete confidence that he would do his job and do it well. He would make certain his detectives were on the case and would make a fair report of all that had happened, for me, for the town of Ferguson, and for the public. Assured that the situation was now in good, capable hands, I hung up, stopped to change out of my weekend clothes into uniform, and drove to the scene. I knew it was going to be a long and difficult day, but no one could have known that the day would stretch to 6 months and would change the lives of so many people, that it would tear our town apart, and that it would alter the feelings of the entire country. By the time I got to Canfield, 45 minutes after the shooting, a crowd of perhaps 200 people had already gathered, and officers were busy establishing a boundary around the area with yellow police tape. The young man's body, Michael Brown, as I would soon learn, lay on the ground just inside the Canfield apartment complex, not visible from West Florissant Avenue, the main road. Some way down the street, a police car was parked at a crooked angle, as if in haste, with the driver's door open. The sergeant told me that an ambulance had already come and gone. While the EMTs were able to pronounce Michael Brown dead at the scene, they could not remove his body before the crime scene investigation team arrived, collected physical evidence, and thoroughly documented the scene. We didn't know then that the team was currently wrapping up their work following a hostage crisis nearly an hour away, and that the time Brown's body would remain there for all to see would stretch on for hours. For the first hour, everything seemed to be stuck in neutral. While we waited for the crime scene investigators, John Belmar's detectives did the best they could to scour and secure the scene. As time passed, the tension and anger in the crowd steadily grew more palpable. This officer-involved shooting had taken place at approximately noon, in full view of people on the street and in the surrounding apartment buildings, and had immediately caught the attention of everybody in the neighborhood. Smartphones armed with Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and messaging apps had sent out news of the shooting within minutes, bringing even more onlookers. Fueled by social media, a narrative had already begun to take shape, even before the press, local authorities, or adequate police arrived. An initial posting online on Twitter read, "Ferguson police just executed an unarmed 17-year-old boy that was walking to the store. Shot him 10 times. SMH." Shaking my head. Before anybody knew any specifics about the shooting, that narrative immediately cast the Ferguson police as the wrongdoers. Taunts and curses such as "Fuck the police" and "Killer cops," as well as shouts for "Justice now," filled the air. As the crowd and the hostility grew, the county captain called what's known as a Code 1000, a kind of all-hands-on-deck for assistance that goes out to all the local law enforcement agencies. I had used this call for assistance in Ferguson in the wake of tornadoes in 2011 and 2013. We felt a sense of foreboding, as if the crowd were closing in and could erupt into mayhem at any moment. The Ferguson lieutenant on the scene was Bill Ballard, a plain-spoken, tough, former Marine drill sergeant.
"Well, Chief," he said, "this went to shit pretty quick."
That about summed it up.
"None of this looks good."
That was the assessment of Anthony Shahid, an activist in African-American issues well known around St. Louis. I saw him standing in the crowd shortly after I arrived and reached out for his help to ease the crowd's nerves and tension. Anthony and I walked the line of police tape around the perimeter of the scene, imploring crowds to stay back and remain calm and to let the police do their job. At Shahid's suggestion, we also enlisted the help of Leslie McSpadden, Michael Brown's mother, who had arrived at the scene. I had never met her, or Michael, or anyone in the family before that day out on Canfield Drive, nor would I have any direct contact with her after that. But her presence there, with Shahid and me, helped to keep the tension from boiling over. I don't know that I could have accomplished that on my own. Most people in Ferguson know me and my officers, many of whom had served Ferguson for decades, and we had strong ties to every part of the community. But in that moment, in that simmering crowd, they saw only police, and police were already perceived to be the bad guys. As the three of us were talking and walking along the perimeter, my cell phone rang. John Shaw, the charismatic young city manager of Ferguson, sounded uncharacteristically grim. John was a top-notch city manager, well-respected in his profession and by his colleagues.
"Chief, I need you to deal with the news people on the scene," he said.
He wanted me to try to head off the bad press that had already begun to circulate about the shooting.
Already?
I don't think either of us understood that ship had sailed. I had only just begun to notice television trucks arriving and reporters with microphones or notepads waiting through the crowd. None of us had had a chance to stop and think how many of the people on the street that day had smartphones with them, and how many had immediately started to circulate text messages, tweets, retweets, hashtags, Facebook posts, or Instagram images. It's important to understand that Canfield Drive and West Florissant Avenue are the main drags of this particular section of Ferguson. The corner where they come together is a central hub in the community, and always busy with cars passing through, pedestrians strolling, and people shopping at a number of stores within 100 yards in any direction. There were always a few people just hanging out. It was as if Michael Brown had been shot in the town square at high noon. It would take months for the county, the FBI, and the United States Department of Justice to sort out the dozens of people who claimed to be witnesses and determine their reliability. But the flood of social media posts was never subjected to that kind of scrutiny, nor were the live television interviews that avid reporters broadcast from the scene. Rumors spread through the crowd like wildfire and took off at an even faster rate through the internet. The rumors, exaggerations, and other misinformation in all those messages became the fuel for the coming firestorm. Things didn't stay calm for very long. I was as surprised as anyone else out there to see a team of officers with police dogs suddenly rush into the crowd. Ferguson canine officer Greg Kasem was already present with his four-legged partner, which at the time was sitting calmly by his side as Greg spoke to members of the crowd. When the county captain realized that the gathering crowds were growing agitated, he had called in for additional canines. It made sense at the time, but the appearance of the new dogs enraged the crowd, bringing back images of Selma. Seeing the problems created by the mere presence of the dogs, the county captain quickly ordered them withdrawn, but the damage had been done. Whatever progress we might have made in settling the crowd suddenly meant nothing. It felt as if so many aspects of the day were developing all at the same time. About 2 hours into the situation, a number of critical things happened. First, a reporter recorded and broadcast an interview from the street with Dorian Johnson, the young man who had been with Michael Brown at the time of the encounter with Officer
Sample complete. Ready to continue?